and rolling, Bob.
Hi folks, this is Chris Gregory here. This is Bob Dylan, A Head Full of Ideas, Season 2.
Is it rolling, Bob?
Is it rolling, Bob?
And in this episode, I'm going to be talking about the famous Isle of Wight concert in 1969. This is called Who's Going to Throw That Minstrel Boy a Coin? Sunday, 31st of August, 1969. It is 10 p.m. and the massive crowd that fills most of the valley at Ryde, Isle of Wight, is getting restless. They've been waiting all weekend for this. On Saturday night, The Who, fresh from their famous appearance at Woodstock less than 2 weeks ago, had headlined Saturday night with a storming set that included a complete performance of their rock opera, Tommy. The day had been more of a folky occasion with Julie Felix, Tom Paxton and Richie Havens all delivering well-received shows. Time is marching on now. People are becoming a bit twitchy. Just over half an hour ago, the main attraction's backing musicians, the band, had taken the stage and were playing a set of their own material. Some good stuff, if a little intricate and self-absorbed for this huge arena, but more and more people were wondering aloud, where is Bob? There had been so much of a build-up. The festival had been headline news in Britain, where nobody has ever seen a crowd this size at a music event. Some said 100, some 150,000. This was many years before festivals were to become multicultural extravaganzas in which several venues operate at the same time. Here, everything was focused on the one small and rather shaky-looking wooden stage, which to most of the crowd occupies only a tiny portion of what they can see in the distance. It's okay for the assorted Beatles, Rolling Stones, Hollywood stars and their ilk, who sit in the celebratory arena at the front. They have a perfect view, but even they must be wondering when the man is actually going to appear. Rumours have been circulating all weekend that the festival will climax in a superstar jam, featuring virtually every known rock star on the planet. It had been over 3 years since Bob Dylan had actually played a concert. The show, the second of two at the Royal Albert Hall on 27th of May 1966, was the climax of perhaps the most startling, historic and iconoclastic musical tour of all time, in which Dylan, backed by most of what would become the band, faced a nightly campaign of booing by a section of his supposed fans who saw his move into playing electric as a commercial sellout and a betrayal of what they interpreted as his political leanings, as supposedly displayed in his earlier protest material. Even though the band's drummer Levon Helm left the tour early, being unable to stomach the nightly onslaught, Dylan and his musicians had carried on defiantly. Indeed, the opposition from this part of the crowd drove them on to levels of musical and emotional intensity which had never been seen on a rock music stage. After the final show, Dylan had retreated from the public eye, making only brief appearances with the band at a Woody Guthrie tribute in early 1968 and at a festival in Mississippi in mid-1969. Even more shockingly for his fans, his music had gone through yet another transformation. His most recent album, Nashville Skyline, had eschewed the long, mysterious and enigmatic songs of his mid-60s golden period in favour of short, sometimes twee, but often infectious country music-influenced ditties with simple, direct lyrics. He had even appeared as a guest on the Johnny Cash TV show, singing his plaintive, lovelorn ballad, I Threw It All Away. If most of the crowd had watched this performance or seen the brief interview Dylan had given to TV cameras before the show, they might have been more prepared for what was about to occur. But the expectation that he is about to unleash a loud, energetic rock show is still immense. The Beatles had also been off the road for this entire period, and the rumour that they might be jamming with Dylan was getting the crowd even more excited. Of course, it is highly ironic that the audience actually wanted Dylan to perform the kind of show which he had been lambasted for just 3 years earlier. But in the context of the 1960s musical and cultural revolution, 3 years was a very long time. Now, the entire way that Rockstows was staged, along with the expectations of the audience, had changed almost beyond recognition. Advances in amplification had meant that bands could now play very loud music without too much distortion. At their last show at Candlestick Park in August 1966, the Beatles were still playing through PA announcement speakers. Naturally, the screams of their fans completely drowned out the music. Some of the reactions against the rock music that Dylan and the band played in 65-66 were actually protests against the poor, often distorted sounds they heard coming out of equipment on which the volume had never been turned up so much. Even now, despite the massive stacks on each side of the stage, the wind could carry the sound away from those at the back. But none of this appears to calm the ardour of the crowd, fired up as they are for Dylan's appearance. Despite his apparently having disappeared into his rural retreat for several years, in 1969 Bob Dylan was at the absolute height of his cultural influence. But he certainly never had a tie-dye or psychedelic period. He came from a slightly older musical generation whose music was firmly rooted in traditional forms. Indeed, the preponderance of studio effects in albums like The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper seems to have set him and the band on an opposite path, as the highly stripped-down John Wesley Harding and the band's groundbreaking and quietly impressive Music from Big Pink had demonstrated. Yet, when he finally steps onto the stage, dressed in, of all things at such a huge gathering of freaks, a white suit, there is a ripple of surprise. He mumbles a hello to the crowd, and then is straight into a sweetened, countrified version of 1965's She Belongs to Me, which begins with the lines, "She's got everything she needs, she's an artist, she don't look back." There will indeed be no looking back. In comparison to the wild-eyed, wild-haired, spaced-out screaming poet of 66, Dylan is reserved and modest. He wears a short beard that makes him look a little like a travelling preacher. At the end of the number, he merely mutters, "Great to be here, sure is." With barely a pause, we are into the next number, a heartfelt version of "I Threw It All Away." By now, the crowd cannot have failed to notice that Dylan is singing not in the screechy adenoidal tones he is famous for, but, as in Nashville Skyline, in a deep, resonant croon. Although these are the same musicians Dylan played with 3 years earlier, the band's sound has also evolved from the full frontal musical attack of 66 to a uniquely tasteful and restrained fusion of country, blues and light funk. Having set the template for what would become heavy rock, Dylan and the band have now moved decidedly away from such styles and are expressing through their music an amalgam of American traditions that would later be given the label Americana. Many observers have been amazed that Dylan had the willpower and strength to complete the grueling 66 tour. That tour, especially in the famous climactic moment of the Manchester show, where Dylan responds to the catcall of Judas from an audience member with the most venomous and powerful "Like a Rolling Stone" ever, has gone down in history as one of the most important in rock history. But in some ways, Dylan's next transformation into the down-home and rather respectable figure he presents himself as at the festival is equally iconoclastic and myth-shattering. At the very height of his fame and influence over the Love Generation, Dylan quite deliberately presents himself as looking and sounding very much like, whisper it, one of their parents. This is, of course, just as it was in 66, a kind of game he is playing with the audience. He has indeed always displayed a tendency to avoid looking back, and has generally delighted in what can only be called perverse presentations of his art, always giving the audience what they least expect. How much of this was communicated to the huge crowd is, however, open to question. In general, the reviews of the show were poor, and many fans came away disappointed. Dylan only played for an hour, in fact, a normal length for a festival set, but a big letdown for all of those who had waited so long to see him. His manner in his limited stage announcements was taciturn, even shy, reminiscent perhaps of Elvis Presley, who, despite his role in kickstarting rock back in the 50s, was hardly a countercultural hero. There was a growing suspicion that Dylan, like Elvis before him, had rejected any role as a cultural rebel and had joined the establishment. In 1969, such a perception was a serious matter indeed. It may also be true that many of the crowd would not have heard the music especially well, given that so many of them were so far away from the stage. And there is no doubt that the music did sound rather strange and unfamiliar. The version of Like a Rolling Stone is a world away from the vicious attack of 66. Here Dylan treats it almost as a joke, enjoying his exchange of harmonies with members of the band and delivering the lyrics in a slightly offhand manner. Once the message of this song was an affirmation of how tough and admirable it was to be a rebel against society's norms. Now it becomes a jaunty sing-along, almost a parody of itself, as if its essential message has, in those momentous 3 years, been changed into something entirely different. Dylan is now facing 100,000 Rolling Stones. Despite the lack of enthusiasm for the show demonstrated by the press and the fans at the time, the Isle of Wight concert has certainly stood the test of time. Four of the tracks later appeared on Dylan's much-maligned self-portrait album in 1970. For many years, the entire show circulated as a bootleg before it was finally released as a free extra disc added to the Another Self-Portrait segment of the Bootleg series. Heard in pristine sound, the performance is uniquely memorable. It would be another 4.5 years before Dylan would return to performing regular shows, but the gigs on the 1974 tour with the band sounded nothing like this. By then, the band were in decline as a unit, as internal disputes and substance problems had begun to pull them apart. On that tour, the attempt to attack the songs in a more conventional rock manner comes over as somewhat contrived and never approaches the intensity of the 66 gigs, despite returning to something more like the style of that era. Here, and only here, does Dylan play a show in which he effectively trades harmonies with the band's three great singers, Richard Manuel, Levon Helm and Rick Danko. The band play with great subtlety and ingenuity. This is the only show in which Dylan uses his Nashville Skyline voice throughout. The arrangements of the songs are also unique. The languorous, even luxurious versions of two songs from John Wesley Harding, I Pity the Poor Immigrant and I Dreamed I Saw St. Augustine, provide a tantalising glimpse of what that album would have sounded like if the band had played on it. Garth Hudson's prominent accordion on Immigrant is highly evocative, backing Dylan's passionate delivery. In Augustine, Dylan rides the staccato rhythm of Levon Helm's drums to a similarly moving effect. On a lively I'll Be Your Baby Tonight, the choruses are greatly enhanced by the band's harmonies. One Too Many Mornings, which had been transformed from an acoustic ballad to an expression of electronic rage in 66, now becomes a country song, again distinguished by the backing vocals on the choruses. On Maggie's Farm, Highway 61 Revisited, and a very rare Mighty Quinn, the musicians certainly rock out, but in a way that is tempered strongly by the band's sub-funk rhythms. Robbie Robertson's tasteful and sparing lead guitar fills distinguish all the songs with great fluidity. Lay Lady Lay, a recent major hit single for Dylan in the UK, is perhaps closest to the album version. The show ends with a crowd-pleasing and rather raucous reading of Rainy Day Women numbers 12 and 35, with the whole multitude naturally wishing that everybody must get stoned in unison. Despite the band's musical and vocal dexterity, arguably the finest segment of the show is the four-song acoustic set, in which Dylan plays solo and sings for the only time as an acoustic artist using what was then his new voice. His rendition of the traditional Wild Mountain Time, a favourite of his in different phases of his career, is quite stunningly sustained, while To Ramona suits the new style perfectly. A light and modest Mr. Tambourine Man makes the song sound like some ancient ballad. But perhaps the outstanding performance is an exquisite and quite beautiful version of It Ain't Me, Babe, a song originally full of sarcasm and denial, but which, delivered here in Dylan's crooning voice, comes over as playfully affectionate yet somehow sad. in terms of its message to the audience. Despite all the build-up and the hype, the song expresses that Dylan is no messiah or prophet of the Love Generation. As he delivers the song with such compassion, he is unequivocal that he is really just a guy. Perhaps the most telling song of all, however, is the first encore, a one-off performance of Minstrel Boy, originally from the Basement tapes in 1967 and included in this version on Self-Portrait. This is a simple country-style ditty which is dominated by some truly wonderful harmonies by Dylan and the band. The song is about a character called Lucky, a busker who is playing music to save his soul. "I'm still on that road," Dylan reminds us. The message is even clearer here than on It Ain't Me, Babe. Dylan is declaring that he's not any kind of saviour, he is just a simple singer playing for pennies. With mock humility, he implores the vast crowd to let him down easy to save his soul. Only then does he let them chant and sway about getting stoned. Listening to the concert today is a tantalising experience. It is impossible not to speculate as to what a Dylan band tour of, say, 1970 or 71 would have sounded like, especially in terms of how the music and the harmonies might have produced startling new takes on much of Dylan's back catalogue. But the show stands alone as a consummate piece of real-life theatre which deliberately upsets audience expectations. Dylan gives a uniquely exceptional performance which, despite originally being seen as a massive anticlimax, now stands as one of the most challenging and distinctive shows of his long career. Okay, that's that. I do hope you enjoyed that. If you look at my website, which is from the pen of Chris Gregory, at chrisgregory.org, chrisgregory.org, you'll find a text version of what I've just read to you, along with some of the limited amount of film that's actually in existence of the concert. And you'll also find lots of other writing on that website about Bob Dylan and a number of other subjects that I've written a book about. I'm the author of Determined to Stand, The Reinvention of Bob Dylan, which is a study of Dylan's later work, and you can buy that on my site or from amazon.co.uk. If you're feeling particularly generous, you might like to go to the site Buy Me a Coffee, and there you can buy me a coffee. If you look up Buy Me a Coffee / Chris Gregoff, Gregoff, I think it's two F's, you should be able to bung me a couple of quid, as we say in England, or throw me a couple of dollars, as you might say in America, or wherever you are, drop me a couple of something. So you might feel like doing that. A bit cheeky, but worth a try. Okay, see you next time. Bye.
Is it rolling, Bob?